The First Testament lesson today is from the book of Genesis, chapter 32, verses 1 through 12, and that can be found on page 29 of the Old Testament. But to set the scene a little bit for this passage, Jacob had been living with his father-in-law Laban for 20 years because of Laban's trickery and deception. Because of his own ingenious plotting, Jacob has become very wealthy and falls out of favor with Laban. The Lord tells Jacob, "Return to the land of your ancestors and your kindred, and I will be with you." But as Jacob journeys toward his homeland, he must pass through the country of his brother Esau, from whom he stole their father's blessing. Now listen for the word of the Lord. Jacob went on his way, and the angels of God met him. And when Jacob saw them, he said, "This is God's camp." So he called that place Mahanaim. Jacob sent messengers before him to his brother Esau in the land of Seir, the country of Edom, instructing them, "Thus you shall say to my lord Esau, 'Thus says your servant Jacob, I have lived with Laban as an alien and stayed until now, and I have oxen, donkeys, flocks, male and female slaves, and I have sent them to tell my lord in order that I may find favor in your sight.' The messengers returned to Jacob, saying, 'We came to your brother Esau, and he is coming to meet you, and 400 men are with him.' Then Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed, and he divided the people that were with him and the flocks and the herds and camels into two companies, thinking, 'If Esau comes to one company and destroys it, then the company that is left will escape.' And Jacob said, 'O God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac, O Lord, who said to me, "Return to your country and to your kindred, and I will do you good," I am not worthy of the least of all the steadfast love and all the faithfulness that you have shown to your servant. For with only my staff I crossed this Jordan, and now I have become two companies. Deliver me, please, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I am afraid of him. He may come and kill us all, the mothers with the children. Yet you have said, "I will surely do you good and make your offspring as the sand of the sea, which cannot be counted because of their number." The word of the Lord.
Our gospel reading this morning comes from Matthew's gospel, the 22nd chapter, verses 15 through 22. The Pharisees went and plotted to entrap Jesus in what he said. So they sent their disciples to him, along with the Herodians, saying, "Teacher, we know that you are sincere and teach the way of God in accordance with truth and show deference to no one, for you do not regard people with partiality. Tell us then what you think. Is it lawful to pay taxes to the emperor or not?" But Jesus, aware of their malice, said, "Why are you putting me to the test, you hypocrites? Show me the coin used for the tax." And they brought him a denarius. Then he said to them, "Whose head is this, and whose title?" They answered, "The emperor's." Then he said to them, "Give therefore to the emperor the things that are the emperor's, and give to God the things that are God's." When they heard this, they were amazed, and they left him and went away. The word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. They ripped paintings off the wall and dashed statues to the ground. They destroyed reliquaries. They smashed stained glass windows and threw rocks at the altar. Within 3 days, they had destroyed every image from within over 400 churches, while their throats were filled with hymns and songs. It was 1566, and the beggars' rebellion in the lowlands of Holland had collided with the Calvinist preachers' denouncements of idolatry in the church. This was the violent birth of Reformed architecture, with its plain white columns and unadorned chancel reflecting a theology opposed to the creation and veneration of any image of God. Calvin devoted 3 chapters of his theological writings to denouncing icons, asserting that images are not suited to represent God's mysteries. I was recently accused of being a good Calvinist, and I do love the simplicity and familiarity of Reformed architecture. But last fall, I took a pilgrimage to Greece and found a new appreciation for the icons that Calvin detested. Orthodox Christianity has a theological history of iconography that extends back, they claim, to the very first Christian churches. Icons are meant not to be objects of worship in and of themselves, but to draw us into the worship of that which they represent. Icons served as visual storytellers for the illiterate, but also as a way for anyone to encounter God through representations of God's incarnation in Jesus Christ. Rather than draw God down to earth, they are meant to be windows into the kingdom, drawing us deeper into the mystery of God. In Greece, I saw hundreds of icons as I toured churches and monasteries all over the country. Icons of Christ, of Mary, of John the Baptist, of saints and martyrs adorned sanctuaries, chapels, and the shelves of gift shops. And while the Calvinist in me objected, I quickly began to grieve for what our tradition has lost. Gazing upon the icon of the Holy Trinity, I was drawn into the mystery of the interrelated Godhead. I experienced theological truth and emotional satisfaction in the image of the ascendant Christ that adorns the dome of each sanctuary. I began to wonder what was wrong with Calvin, that he couldn't see the value of sacred art. I felt no need to bow or kiss the icons as the Orthodox believers did, but nor did I feel compelled to destroy them as false idols. I began to feel that I was trapped somewhere between 2 traditions that had somehow failed to meaningfully converse about this issue throughout the course of history. First century Judaism had its own controversies regarding sacred art. Some kinds of art were objectionable, while others seemed completely acceptable. But the image at the center of today's story is not at first recognized as sacred in any way, and therefore is not controversial for its iconic quality. Let me begin by setting up this encounter a little bit. Jesus has entered Jerusalem triumphantly and has proceeded to heap insult and injury on the religious leadership. He turns over tables in the temple and tells parables that criticize the Jewish authorities. And now they've had enough. The Pharisees, you might remember, are keen to uphold the letter of the law in order to maintain their Jewish identity within the context of Roman occupation. And they team up here with some unlikely collaborators, the Herodians. The Herodians were, as you might guess, devotees of Herod, the ruler set up over the Jews by the Roman authorities, making the Herodians much more willing to assimilate to Roman culture. They were keen to maintain positive relations with Rome and thereby keep their power and authority. What these 2 strange bedfellows have in common is a desire to keep the peace. An uprising of Jewish zealots would endanger the lives of all Jews. Any interruption in the fragile peace of the region would be dangerous. And from what they've heard and seen of Jesus, he could potentially be a rather major interruption. And so they come together to trap him in his own words. The question is simple. As a wise teacher who follows God and doesn't take sides, do you think it's lawful to pay taxes to the emperor or not? But what is at stake in this question has nothing to do with taxes. Instead, it is the other certainty that we're concerned with here, death. You see, on the one hand, paying taxes, meaning tribute, to a man who claims to be the Son of God, as the emperor does, could be seen as an infraction of the second commandment, a sin punishable by death. And while the Jewish leaders don't have the authority to enact this punishment, if they can get Jesus to advocate for breaking this commandment, they can discredit and disgrace him. On the other hand, to refuse to pay taxes would amount to sedition, a crime also punishable by death. In fact, it is one of the accusations made against Jesus before Pilate. The question that is really being asked here is an impossible one, and the Pharisees and the Herodians know it. Will Jesus side with the idolatrous Romans or be a seditious Jew? It's a lose-lose. It's a brilliant scheme. But they underestimate just how good of a rabbi Jesus really is. When he looks at that coin used to pay taxes, a coin that shows the head of the emperor and has an inscription claiming that he is the Son of God, when he looks at that coin, Jesus doesn't see a choice between idolatry and sedition. Jesus sees a man made in the image of God, as it says in the first chapter of Genesis, created a little lower than the angels, as it says in the eighth Psalm. Jesus sees a coin worth a day's wage, and he remembers the commandment to keep the Sabbath, to give one day of every week back to God. Jesus is not trapped, because he knows something that the Pharisees and the Herodians have clearly forgotten. Jacob, for all his faults, is well aware of the truth that is about to shock the Pharisees and the Herodians. In our story today, Jacob is trapped between his father-in-law, Laban, from whom he has just narrowly escaped, and his brother, Esau, from whom he stole their father's blessing. Jacob can't go back to a life of servitude under Laban, but he's terrified of what his brother is going to do to him when he sees him. In this tight spot, Jacob does two important things. He recognizes the sovereignty of God, and he pays his taxes. Jacob prays to God, recognizing that all he has is a gift from God and that he is not worthy of the favor that he has received. Everything is from God and belongs to God and gives glory to God. And he knows that he's following God's will by returning to his homeland. But he also knows that Esau is not going to be happy to see him, and rightly so. And so Jacob pays tribute to Esau. He sends him hundreds of animals from his flock. He doesn't worry about whether the percentage is too high or too low, or whether or not Esau is going to use the animals in a way that he finds acceptable. Jacob remembers that these things are not his in the first place. They belong to God. And when Jacob and Esau finally meet, you know what Jacob says to Esau? He says, "To see your face is to see the face of God." This is what Jesus sees, a world that is created by God and belongs to God. The image, the icon of a man made in God's image. The question about taxes is beside the point. If what you see on that coin is the image of a man-made God, then you must choose between idolatry and sedition. But if what you see on that coin is the image of a man made in God's image, then give to Caesar what is Caesar's and give to God what is God's. Like an Orthodox icon, Jesus uses the coin to open a window into the mystery and truth of God's kingdom. While I mourn the loss of sacred art and am ashamed of the Protestant iconoclasts, I agree that we must vigilantly oppose idolatry. But I don't fear images painted on wood or sculpted in marble. I'm not concerned about stained glass or ornamented sanctuaries. But when I see a Photoshop celebrity or a self-aggrandizing selfie, I have to ask, who do I see here? Is it a human-made God or a God-made human? I am trapped between idolatry and cultural sedition all the time. But the freedom offered to us in Jesus Christ is the assurance that the world is being remade, that humanity has been redeemed, and that we will one day see God face to face. And until then, we can see God in the face of each person we meet. We can see God's face everywhere, but only through the lens of God's sovereignty. We are surrounded by idols and icons. Very often they are the same thing. We can idolize people, or like Jacob, in their faces, we can see the face of God. We can idolize our money, or like Jesus, use it as an opportunity to remember that everything belongs to God. And so I invite us to smash the idols and embrace the icons. Get rid of our hang-ups about what belongs to whom and remember that everything belongs to God. Use every image, every icon, as an opportunity to see the face of God, to whom be all glory forever and ever. Amen.